Hello everyone, thanks for being here. If you are here, that means you can see me. If you're just hearing this, that means that you just clicked on the audio on the Last Estate, our arts and culture website. My name is Gabriel Hart. I'm gonna be the sacrificial lamb tonight. I'm gonna read a story called Crossing Alvarado. It was published in issue 6 of Rock and a Hard Place. Crossing Alvarado is a story about white boys who want their cocaine and expect the gangsters to be DoorDash demanding them to deliver it to the party, and just sort of what happens when that ecosystem gets disrupted. There's a guy named Levi. He's hanging out with the veteranos on the stoop. We're gonna kind of fast forward. And you figure out why he's kind of hanging out on the stoop with the old gangsters. Cocaine had recently pinned Echo Park hipster culture in a stranglehold, and Levi's neck wasn't spared. It was his other Friday night ritual with his closer inner circle. He, Billy, and Travis would pitch in to buy a bag from their buddy Johnny. He'd make a call, a quick ride, then return within the hour with a gram or two to last them the weekend. Only Johnny had just left for tour the day before, so they were out of luck for a month. Knowing the dry spell was coming, Travis and Billy had been pressuring Levi to ask his neighbors, since he claimed he was like an honorary Mexican. This way they could score it cheaper, assuming Johnny was overcharging them, taking a cut. Oh shit, Levi's wants to get fucking crazy, said Eddie. Nah, we don't know. Jorge interrupted, whispering in his ear. Eddie shrugged. It's your kid, man, if you want. Sal just shook his head, grinning with abandon. Hey, so my son has a friend, said Jorge. He sells, only he's right behind us. He's now just getting into Big Top. Big Top? Big Top Locos, remember? Oh, shit, okay. I mean, is that cool with you guys? Yeah, of course. Not like any of us sell, so it's no backstab. Just don't be stupid, you know? You didn't hear from us. And do your business up there, yeah? Jorge hollered to his kid Ernie upstairs. 30 seconds later, he was on the stoop. Words were exchanged in Spanish that went too quick for Levi. For him? Ernie asked. Yeah, Levi's right here. Oh, okay. You just have to meet him on the corner, though. Give me a second and I'll text him. Ernie told him to have 120 ready for a handshake at the corner. Yeah, of course, said Levi, as if he had done it a million times. All right, he's leaving now. You should too, said Ernie. Ah, there goes crazy Levi, said Eddie, watching him jump off the stoop into a skip, then an accelerated walk up the street. One block up and two blocks to the right, he saw a young kid leaning against the stop sign. Not a day over 18, he motioned at him at his chin. You Levi's? Yeah. Vito. They shook hands, green for white. Thanks, Vito. You mind if I call you sometime? He nodded. Just have Ernie give you my number. Levi returned to the stoop within 5 minutes. Hey, hey, Jorge said, lightly backhanding Levi's shoulder. Did Rodolfo tell you his name was Vito Corleone? He said, Vito. The three of them doubled over in hysterics. Fucking Rodolfo. Levi wasn't the only white guy on Santa Ynez. There were sprinkles of other new tenants and there were there when he moved in. But 6 months later, the neighborhood looked glaringly different. Paler, yet harder for him to relate to. The transition felt conspiratorial, like the for rent signs were popping up quicker than the U-Hauls could catch up with. Once again, Levi was confident he had been way ahead of the curve, yet as comfortable as he was in his rundown building, he hoped he wasn't a candidate to get sold like he had seen happen to others. He wouldn't be able to afford a rent hike, yet somehow he could always afford cocaine. Friday nights at Levi's pad became considerably larger affairs now that he was the new Johnny, the go-to middleman for coke. Friends half friends, names he could barely remember, even complete strangers were smiling through the threshold to grab their order, do a couple lines, do a couple more lines while Levi spun records from his impressive collection, keeping it all lively and moving. For the couple months of heyday, every Saturday morning they were somehow surprised when the sun came up, interrupting their deceptively endless eve. By fall, the hangers-on began letting go, the outer layer of the inner circle disappearing in mysterious yet inevitable cyclic flow, leaving it back to the core of Levi, Billy, and Travis, restlessly alone on a Friday night. Shit, so where are the girls at? Fuck, where's everybody at is more like it, said Levi, half-heartedly flipping the record. I bet I know where everyone is. You guys know the Alvarado house up there by Sunset? Said Travis. Levi recalled seeing crowds of people leaving there on a couple weekends in a row at 5 a.m. as he passed by on the way to his early morning shifts. Ah, yeah, right. You been there? Dude, it's crazy. It's an after hours, like a speakeasy, full bar for after the bars close. They have the sunken lower level of their property that's covered with a series of tarp, so it's like a huge VIP tent, like a music festival or something. Cops don't even fuck with it. You can't even see it from the street. Girls? Yeah, tons. Well, shit, let's go right now then. It was after midnight, pushing 1 a.m. If they left that second, Travis said they'd be holding court by the time the bars let out and the place got crowded. Levi took his little baggie out to cut up three more lines. Shit, this is it, boys, he said, scraping the remnants of the caking dredges. He got three good little piles out of it, but that was it for their weekend supply. What, we fucking did all that? Yeah. What are we gonna do? Don't worry, just do these and bail the Alvarado house. I'll call Vito from there and have him meet us. With no regard for the lines they just done 10 minutes before these last ones, the three were already in accelerated delirium, their heads in sublime numbness, unaware of how fast they were talking to each other. They each cleared the 10 steps down with one jump, hands swinging their bodies from the railing, the night air hitting their faces with a refreshing jolt of invincibility. Shuffling down the driveway, they made a left and a right on Alvarado, following Travis since he knew the way. They crossed Alvarado. They arrived at the lawn as Travis led them to the side where a bouncer with a headset stood posted at the entrance. Evening, fellas, you know the password? Password? Who do you know? Man, I was just here last weekend, said Travis. You from the neighborhood? I live right around the corner, said Levi. All right, you guys are good then. In the future, the password is private party, because that's what this is if anyone asks. Got it? Full bar, cash only. He stamped their hands and waved them through. You gonna call Vito? Asked Billy. Fucking chill out, let's get a drink first, said Levi. They followed the chattering cacophony to their right into a massive tent that occupied the whole periphery of the backyard's lower knoll. 100 or so wasted revelers spilling out, most dressed to the nines in expensive apparel. Fuck, these don't even look like people from the neighborhood. Once their eyes settled at the dim lighting, Levi led them to the makeshift bar and got the first round, three double whiskey cokes, $30. He checked to make sure he had enough cash for Vito. Exhaling with relief, he dialed his number. What's up, Levi's? Hey, can you bring me 2 G's? Sure, you're Pat? Nah, but I'm close. Can you meet me? Depends. Where you at? You know the Alvarado house? Is that on the other side of Alvarado? Yeah. Nah, I ain't going there. Just meet me at your pen. Nah, man, come on. Just meet me here. It took me a lot to get in here. Levi was stressing because he already saw Travis and Billy talking to two girls, and he was missing out on his own potential catch. When you get to the door, just say private party, and they'll wave you in. Nah, man, just go to your house. Fuck. They argued back and forth as Levi paced, unaware of the scene he was making, head down, assuming it'd make his Discord less conspicuous, until he bumped into someone. Hey, fucking watch it, homie, a man said, shoving Levi back. A real guy from the neighborhood, and he had already pissed him off. Shit, my bad, sorry, man. He dove back into Vito, embarrassed, patience gone. Dude, just get over here. He noticed the same guy passing a baggie to one of the girls giving him green for white. Or I'll start taking my business elsewhere. Fuck you, Levi's. Fine, leaving now. Remember, say private party. Click. 2 minutes later, Vito was crossing Alvarado, nearly giving himself whiplash from looking both ways, over and over. Levi deflated when he saw the guy who showed him, who shoved him wasn't just talking to the girls, but to Travis and Billy as well. It seemed amicable, but he was going to re-enter his circle looking the fool. Hey, man, sorry again about bumping you back there. It's all good, bro. You looked like you were dealing with some shit. Ha, you looked like me talking to my old lady. Hey, private party? Go ahead, full bar, cash only. Thanks, I'm going to be in and out real quick. Vito strutted in, head waving like a cobra through the crowd. The tent area was so packed he struggled to see over the pond of heads. Hey, Vito, he beelined to Levi. Thanks for coming, man. Sorry about the static on the phone, he said, feeling genuinely remorseful. Now that it was all good and he was getting what he wanted. Yeah, you fucking owe me one, man. Your house from now on, right? He turned their backs to Billy, Travis, the girls, and the guy. Only the guy was peering over their shoulders as they traded green for white. Yo, what the fuck, he said. Hey, who are you? Vito deflated, shoved the cash in his pocket, and put his hands up like, hey, it's cool. Nah, man, fuck that. Where you from? Hey man, he's from Big Top and he's just leaving, please, Levi said. Oh, is that right, huh? You got 30 seconds, little man, he said, pulling a gun from behind his waist, aiming at Vito as he took off running, now a moving target. Two more guys came from nowhere with their pistolas. The crowd gasped silent, so scattered girls could scream. Travis and Billy were stunned in wide-eyed cocaine paralysis as they watched Levi run after them. Levi, don't! Levi jumped behind a bush when he heard the one, then the two, then the three, four, five, six shots ring into the air. Shivering, he looked through the hedge to see Travis and Billy running from the side of the house, hanging a sketchy left, the opposite direction from Levi's street. They could tell Santa Ynez was where the gunshots were from. He looked right, saw the coast was clear, then jumped out of the bush to catch up with them. They blended into the Friday night Sunset Boulevard foot traffic, talking a mile a minute as they crossed Alvarado. "No way were those warning shots," said Levi, a helicopter searchlight passing over the Alvarado house, then illuminating the rest of the street. "Stop looking, they're going down your street, fuck." It was 2:16 a.m., everything closed except gas stations. "Where are we gonna go? What do you mean? We gotta hide, man." "Why, we didn't do anything wrong." "Yeah, you didn't do anything wrong, maybe," said Levi, eyes glued to his shuffling feet, afraid to make eye contact with anyone or anything. "We gotta go to your house, Billy." "What? Just fucking say okay, fuck, okay." In two blocks, they arrived at Billy's but didn't enter. Instead, they sat on his porch, staring ahead in silence, the sirens and helicopters not allowing them to get a word in. And when the sour orchestras of municipal emergency ceased, Levi told them to shut up, stop asking questions, his own voice compromised, stuttering as he was shivering, but it was still 90 degrees out at 3 a.m., humidity causing a thick, low-hanging fog, paralyzing the exhaust of Sunset Boulevard to intertwine with the dirty sock smell of the jacarandas into their urban miasma. Billy made himself useful with zero-hour hospitality. The three nursed beers to soften their crash as slivers of sun crept behind them, like lightening the dark of eve into a shifting hallucinatory green, untrustworthy. "Okay, I'm gonna try to go home," said Levi. "You want us to go with you?" "Nah, I need to be alone." "Okay, man. Hey, Levi, I hate to ask, but..." He reached into his pocket, tossed both grams over his shoulder as he stepped off the porch, way ahead of him. He turned onto Santa Ynez from Alvarado, seeing strips of yellow partitioning off the mouth of his driveway, leading all the way to the other side of the street. Two cop cars were parked at 90 degrees, parallel to the caution tape, barricading the crime scene. A few officers talked to neighbors, jotting notes. He saw Eddie, Jorge, and Sal posted up on the stoop where he had left them, right when he was just getting his Friday night started. Since the other two had their heads down, Eddie spotted Levi, signaling him with a whistle. A glimmer of relief for Levi, a slight beacon in their turbulence, though not enough to break his cowardice. "What the fuck happened?" he asked, sincere in his denial. "Vito," Eddie made a swiping gesture on his own neck. "Dead?" Eddie nodded slightly with a finger gun. Levi acted more surprised than he should have, then realized he was genuinely shocked, hearing a confirmation he couldn't run from anymore. He was at his own damn house. Where else was there to go? Eddie shook his head, shrugging his shoulders. "Thing is, it was just a matter of time with Rodolfo. He had it coming." Eyes on his shoes, Levi told him he should be going. Thanks. Next up is Linda Ravenswood. Linda's been coming up to the desert quite a bit with Jennifer Lewis's Red Light Lit. And she is the author of the Stand poems. Are you the founder of Los Angeles Press? Is that? And she is the founder of Los Angeles Press. Please give it up for Linda Ravenswood.
Yikes. Thank you, Gabriel. I don't know if I need specs, but they're here in case. Welcome to Gabriel Hart's The Last Estate. Thank you so much for coming out. Please give it up for Gabriel Hart. Thank you so much for inviting me, sir. I heard some really good news, which is so exciting. This crazy poem that I wrote is now on the shortlist for the Oxford Prize. I can't even believe it, so I'm going to read it for you tonight. Because I'm 183 years old and I finally have like a book out and I don't know, it's all happening. So it's called Elementary School, and as are several of my poems, it's in tribute to Bridget Pegeen Kelly, who's a fabulous poet who has left us. So this is Elementary School. I'm always a bridesmaid. It probably won't win, but it's nice to be on the shortlist. Elementary school. There was a goat's head hanging by ropes in a tree, she said. You have to forgive men, I immediately wanted to say, for how long? But I knew she'd say, it's a process and a cycle, that we have to thank them for wheels and the trips to CVS and the houses, that it's a balancing act for everything, everywhere. That marriage is about, in the end, coming to an agreement that you both need each other, especially as you get on in life. Three husbands, four husbands, lots of sons. The song of the nightbird, she said. They say it's something men are, like it's what boys do. Something comes over them. Maybe it's a little bit of biology. Maybe it's a little bit dark anatomy. They just don't know why they did it. They were in a group of them, and it was like a cloud. They all saw red or black or some color. It's built into society to forgive them, to punish them hard, and then forgive them, to punish them hard and never forgive them. It's built in. You have to say sorry, and you have to mean it. Cried like a man and struggled hard, she said. Even a woman recognizes the struggles of a man. Even a woman talking about the murderous intent of children who happen to be young men in the making. Even there, a sweet song of forgiveness shocks the night with its beauty, its tenderness, the sweetness of I'm sorry. Everybody cries for a man you lost, a man you never knew. And would you be surprised to know your own father had a dungeon? Not a metaphorical dungeon, but an actual dungeon where he did things that men do. Things he needs to be forgiven for. Things he will be forgiven for. Songs he'll sing to be forgiven for. The way his song goes on forever when his song is a cry for forgiveness for the things men do. Thank you. And then this is coming out in Variant Lit tomorrow. It's also a new poem called Untitled Note from Oregon. A pair of blood-stained gloves in tall grass was left, a sigil from wine sap into the Columbia. That was the place where they slept, somehow unbothered by fleas and ticks. Grass went high as a horse head, and even the donkey lay down. On the lower ridge, they pulled mosquitoes to their fists, 10 or 15 at a time. Boils on their necks and in dark places oozed for months. The babies sucked rags dipped in the blood of offal, but came through winter. On bluffs overlooking the Okanogan, we saw Native women coming with camas hanging from their belts. They placed the camas bulbs in a pit and covered them over with sweet grass. When they had steamed, they sliced them like onion heads, a sweet purple taste, smokiness of earth and seeping greens. With translucent camas tongues falling on our fingers, we looked to the sky, straining to find a bridge from our grandparents, and saw they had left us everything. Thank you. And then I'll read one piece from a new collection that's coming out November 25th, and I'll have a little reading here at Stories and some other places, Hauser and Worth. I should have put a post-it on it. It's the story of when I was a child, and I think it goes with the theme. All my poems go with the theme of like horrible, frightening city life, and a memory of some other kind of civilization. This is about a real life story woman. She was just a teenager and she was captured, and this happened in like San Bernardino, her arms were cut off and she was left to die in the desert. But well, I wrote about it. Here it is. Happy Halloween. Desert girl, arms hanging, alive. When I was a child, the Herald Examiner legged open on kitchen beams between lamps and books and cream of wheat and glass brown beer bottles and the smudged elbows of flea market men in faint smells of Listerine and Doane's pills, with rice pudding cooling on the counter of vanilla, lemon, yellow Los Angeles. My grandmother read aloud the story of Desert Girl, arms chopped and smeared with sand, walking out of the desert. Her blood drowned the tarmac as she fled the scene of the crime, rolled from the culvert, and clung to the side of the earth on the highway. She was alive like those gold sleepers from the Twilight Zone. It was out somewhere, past San Bernardino, past civilization, and back to railroads and stagecoaches, and people come from the east. our progenitors, those faces from the photo album, stranger, etched names on the silver service, Willis, McGee, portraits made in St. Joseph, Missouri on their way west. What could be worth so much to sleep for 1,000 years? The hub hooped black 1957 tub covered in a canvas tarp, the glass cage chambers slumbering through centuries, the skull and bone leavings of a too early crack, this desert, all hope and oblivion, eternally in one landscape. Did Desert Girl wake in blue numbness, or did she never sleep, consciousness beside her like faith or stars, going by gas caps and jackrabbits along the scrub and stem of the horizon? The first car she saw was filled with girls and boys. Farther and then beside her, horrified, her river of blood and sanguine dress, her remnants of arms above her, call on me, take me to my mother. Later, she said she held her arms high to keep her muscles from slipping out. But the boys and girls were too scared to stop, so the Desert Girl walked for hours till an old couple stopped and wrapped her in some beach towels they had in the back and took her to a hospital where someone dug in the grotto of her thighs to harvest sinew and bring her arms half home and bring her all the way out of the desert. But she lived to tell the tale. And my grandmother folded the paper, turned my grandfather's morning sausage, and plated last night's T-bone in her lemon true kitchen. The bone, she said. That's the best part. I saved it just for you. And I sat in Los Feliz with my grandparents and cried for unknown girls. Thank you. Thank you so much. Coming up next is... Thanks a million. And back to Gabriel.
Next up, all the way from Minneapolis, we got Adam Johnson. Adam Johnson's the author of Cialis Verde Ginjag, a harrowing maximalist masterpiece, in my opinion. I, if you want to find out more about Adam, I interviewed him for Lit Reactor a couple months ago. He's not fucking around. He's going to read a little bit from the novel. Here's Adam.
Thank you, Gabriel. And I am just messing around.
No, you're not.
Okay. Good? Okay. So this is a story about a man in his later years who becomes obsessed with the wife of his youngest son. And this is from the beginning of the book. I remember distinctly the day I met Bella. I had a toothache, and it may have even been my wife's birthday. Heather, bless you, you know I was no good with them. The afternoon was one of those clement summertime bubbles of sun and light breeze, the kind of idyllic atmosphere fit for a ball game, or, if one is jaded or beyond 60, a muzzy, regretful reverie in the backyard shade, beneath a rotting ash tree in my case, half a pack of cigarillos, barefoot, a Panama hat, the humanist review, metallic bowfly dying in my gin lemonade, a winged cerulean corpse drowned in sugar water, the whole thing a scene of obscenity. The static text of a bad poem, the madrigal venery, rested in my lap, half-read. My own notebook sat verseless, untouched, a vellum coaster for the sodden coffin of the fly, who by the day's end I believe I had cried over in a drunken state. Oh, but now I know it was on account of your departure that day, my dear Bella Bella, my bellflower, my bellatrist's muse, my Isabel is my Bella. I could go on and on, drinking this gin, making these injections, filling up bottles with piss, ordering... redacted, downing Cialis like a goddamned goblin-eating cheeses, but I'm getting ahead of myself. I never considered myself a conqueror of women. How could I? At 45, I was a terrible likeness to Cézanne's rendering of Henri Gasquet, and I can now consider myself, some 15 or so years later, perhaps the farthest thing from a Don Juan as has ever existed on terra firma, that is, on solid earth, where we all occupy our own little plot of physical space in the rolling carnival. I had one partner in life, Heather, and we got along as couples will, missionary only, secundum artem, until the termination of the honeymoon phase, when the marriage evolved, carefully chosen, over devolved, to a point of sexless nightly routine. How is your book? Should I set the alarm clock for 6 or 6:30? How does your stomach feel? Good night, dear. I was never very sexually animated indeed, only thought. Erotic impulses were not my motivation for activity. That is, until some kind of furious moxie was roused deep within me on that regular summer day when Walter would introduce us, Heather and I, to, you have her name, the wondrous sylph. When the afternoon closed, that is to say, when I had sat long enough to really loathe myself and life in the growing shade, when the Favovian current scattered the atoms of day to a near eastern region in the early evening, not quite eventide, for it was still light, mind you, descended on the back lawn, then did I join Heather at the double vanity to begin those occupations antecedent to a dinner party, viz. A clean shirt and shave, fresh trousers and socks, a splash of eau de cologne, and an inspection of a pounding molar that I've now complained of twice in the course of 500 words, more or less. It was around 6 p.m. that Heather dutifully confronted my non-recognition of the date on which she was born however many decades before. Another faux pas by aloof Godard. Then in this order. 1. An apology, hang knee tribute for show. 2. A farcical female scorn followed precipitously by forgiveness. And 3. A makeup. Oh, pacified Heather, life was so easy in your house. A flower waiting for you post-shower by the misty sink plucked from the garden in my bath towel. I was still your devoted husband. Walter called, said he'd be late. My tooth hurt excessively, and I medicamented myself with some pills that a struggling actor had promised would reduce pain. Heather prepared the food and table while I reddened my teeth with wine in the study. I had retired from my career too early an age, but I enjoyed my pension and a secret inheritance, which included a breathtaking maison in the south of France. And I had made a habit of occupying myself with a paper or an essay in my home study, that dusty crypt where Heather dared not tread for all our years. It was a cramped space, but if anything, I am an anti-claustrophobe, and I hadn't ever climbed the walls, as the saying goes. I could spend a comfortable week in a black box under the earth with only my thoughts and a little air to breathe, food to eat, water to drink, and if I may envision it as a hygienic experiment, some means to discard my waste. I've never really feared true physical confinement, which is a good thing considering my instant circumstances. On the topic of claustrophobia, there was an interesting in vivo experiment by O. Godard, aloof buzzard, my friend, myself, in that isolated preprandial wine daydream of your study. How could you have known? Plumless dunce, how could you have known then of the imperial virgin in the A-line flower skirt and white cotton blouse on her way to your very residence? That stockingless pixie who would walk up through the parterre of your lawn and grace the steps to your door, attached at the arm to her debonair husband, your son Walter, who in his usual sinless way would overlook the peacock feather growing in the canthi of his father's sable eyes. I grew tired in my study, Malbec. I had met two of Walter's flames on prior occasions, two visually pleasing women from the boy's post-college life who he thought worthy of an introduction to his immediate ancestors. Walter was an attractive young man, as was our mailman. He charmed the fair sex without much effort and was able to beguile the better looking among their ranks, which, as I learned in Walter's case, were two women who regarded Middlemarch as a formal date in late winter and the nom de plume, my words, for a rum-based punch, the recipe for which, gasp, she could not then recall. I didn't remember it, Heather did, but Walter had vowed after them to only introduce us next time to his future wife. Walter quested after bloom and polish, quite a different path from his elder brothers, who, being married, had gone in dynamically repressed for the rough-hewn hauler of laundry basket type of companion and decently resembling their mother. I studied the little curios haunting the top of my gentleman's desk, the bric-a-brac associated with a learned man's profession acquired over time, a small leaden paperweight in the bust of Young, a copper dirndled figurine, a Visconti Rembrandt roller pen, an El Casco small stapler, a cufflink case, a briar wood pipe, and an ornate wooden German clock, an ancient calendar from my days of appointments, and the audible yelling of my own name, the last overheard as I sat drowsily in a state of venous buoyancy reflecting on the chimes in the hall, Heather's footwork, the door, voices in plural, an alien female soprano followed by Heather, foul, off-key contralto, calling after me a second time. I rise. Eager, surprised, pulled out of an ill humor and smiling ridiculously into space, thus did I leave my bantam bower in search of my grown boy and his affianced flame. Such was I, the first moment I encountered Bella, standing there bare-legged, a glowing peach, beneath a plastered arch in the principal corridor of my own foyer. Dad, this is Isabel. Oh, thank you, Walter. Thank you from the bottom of my malignant heart. You suffering son, thank you for that ciphered moment of rapture, that unforeseen tryst. I received Walter first. I gripped him tight against my body, rubbed his back from the neck to just below the waist, kissed his cheek, kissed his forehead, grabbed at his side, and held him in front of me before embracing him with a second round of caresses. I did all of these things so that my performance of them on Bella was not without its justification and precedent. Every act was perfectly calculated during that first squeeze with his darling. My hand stopped high enough above the superior aspect of the buttock to satisfy my urge without inspiring alarm in my lovely guest. My fingers moved up her back, where they read like braille the lace filigree of her brassiere. My warm paw came to rest with a gentle sweep on the nape of her neck, where my knuckles were tickled by the felled, still wet from shower cilia of her walnut hair, the scent of which I sampled. I hadn't seen my son in such a long time. I was happy, outwardly, to see him. And if I was too liberal with my hands on the new miss, if I got carried away in paying my respects, well, chalk it up to the enthusiasm of a loving, excited, innocent old father absorbed in a moment of ripe prison. I know you covered for me, Walter, loyal son. I know that in the car ride home, when she broached the subject of old wandering hands, you defended your papa, the bubbly, cuddly, wine-bibbing, rubbing type, in vino deceptum. The banal temptation incited by the post-Gattermod cliché dictates that I compare her to some still-life product of the Florentine Renaissance, that I write Venus, Venus, in the garden, in the shell, and get up plaudits by the invocation of Sandro, that I compare her to some late classical muse entombed in paste-in red figure, that I hearken versification, that I toil over a paragraph as a king of shreds and patches with the sole mission of excessive literary ornateness and affectation. I must snub these seductions. No artist on earth has ever captured the sensual pulse of live flesh, and the closest that Bella has ever come to art was in a black and white profile shot by Luc Fornal. What crumbs of cold ash when compared to her in rippling technicolor? I exclaim these things, which is the reason for that vertical mark denotative of zeal, and I am a zealous connoisseur. It was an instantaneous kind of infatuation there in the foyer. Presents with appropriate affect and demeanor, my old clinician's brain, toes, ankles, calves, knees, beginning of thighs, sublime, fingers, wrists, elbows, shoulders, mine, mine, mine. This I repeated to myself throughout dinner, hummed even. My femme fatale, with your ambrosial hair, your sweet, ravissant, bottle green eyes, your nose, your mouth, your cheeks, your illimitable symmetry, your lithesome finish. A smell of that hair and a taste of flesh would chill me to the very marrow of my bones. I refrained from reaching for her throat for the sole purpose of seeing her eyes widen in the brilliance of the chandelier. I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Next up, we have Grant Womack. He is the author. He dropped two books last month, right?
Yeah.
He's the author of God's Leftovers from Bizarro Pulp Press, and Black Gypsies from Broken River Books, which he's going to read from tonight. Please give it up for Grant Womack.
Thank you. Appreciate it. All right. Yeah, so Black Gypsies is a crime novella, takes place in Chicago. So I'll be reading a couple of sections. All right, so this is part of chapter 10 called Stained City. Good things come to those who take, Gordo said, taking a pull of his blunt. Sounds like something my uncle would have said. Marcus waved the smoke out of his face. Sorry about that, nigga. Your uncle was a relatively smart man. He wouldn't be in and out of jail if he was that smart. Keyword, relatively. Gordo's round face was consumed by a cloud of marijuana smoke. That's just part one of the stained scriptures. When will we hear part two? When I figure it out, nigga. No one was asking bell hooks, Aristotle, or Dr. Umar Johnson when they were writing part two of their books or lectures. It takes time to come up with these philosophies. On God, I feel you. You still planning to write a book one day? You already know. It's percolating up here and down here. Gordo pointed to his head and then pointed to his stomach. And then it will spill out on the page. There is a heavy knock on the window. Gordo almost dropped his blunt. He took a deep breath and rolled the window down to a set of grinning teeth. A couple were missing while the others were stained yellow. Fuck you want. You almost blew my high, Gordo said. The missing teeth man held a squeegee in his left hand and clutched a bucket of dirty water in his other. His dark skin was tough as leather and freckles dotted his face like stars in a lost galaxy. Care to get your windshield cleaned? Sure. The squeegee man hurried to the front of the car and cleaned the window in a frantic fashion. With each pull of the squeegee, it emitted a sharp, squeaky sound. Gordo looked up at the red light, wondering how long they had been sitting there. That'll be $2, sir. Gordo scrounged around his pockets and came up short. I got you, Marcus said, handing over a $5 bill to Gordo, who transferred the money to the squeegee man. Much appreciated. Squeegee man tipped an invisible hat and moved out of traffic's way as the light turned green and Gordo sped off. Who's that? Gordo asked. Nobody, Marcus said, looking down at his phone. You can answer it. We're on a job. Right answer. You passed the test. Marcus nodded, looking out the window. Gordo and Marcus cruised underneath a gold-lettered sign proclaiming, Welcome to Chinatown. They passed a number of storefronts, banks, and restaurants with names veiled in Chinese symbols. The scent of Chinese food wafted inside the cracked window, and Gordo's stomach grumbled. Might have to grab some fried rice and egg rolls on the way back, Gordo said. Good idea. We'll celebrate with some takeout. Look over there, Gordo said. A black Dodge Charger with tinted windows and shimmering hubcaps parked on the side of the street. It looked mean. Gordo loved how smooth the engine sounded whenever he heard one pull up to the auto shop. They parked down the road. Gordo scoped out the side street for any nosy fucks or cameras hidden in storefronts. No one seemed to be out. Still, he didn't like taking chances. Earlier that year, him and Marcus almost got caught stealing a Louis Vuitton bag some lady left resting against her groceries. As she pulled money out the ATM 5 feet away, she turned around screaming, and they dipped down the street, barely getting away. Gordo looked down on his watch, and his stomach grumbled. Looks like it's about that time, nigga. Marcus nodded and got off the passenger side. Popped the trunk. Gordo grabbed the car jack from the back. He moved like a bear, eyes fixated on the charger. Getting down on his hands and knees, he inserted the car jack underneath the center of the car. He was overweight, but his heavy frame also gave him a distinct advantage over his coworkers when it came to moments like this. He cranked the jack with his forearm. Sweat dripped down his face as the car lifted off the ground. Now that's magic, baby, Gordo said. I see you, Marcus said. Grab the lug wrenches. Marcus fished out two lug wrenches from the trunk and handed one to his partner. They removed the lug nuts from the wheels and admired how clean the hubcaps were. These are going to bring in some paper. Can't wait to get to the junkyard and get paid. All I see are dollar signs. Gordo popped a hubcap off the rim and he set it aside carefully. He took a certain pride in disassembling a car. It gave him a sense of purpose. It was his own island of clarity, Zen. He tried meditating with a girl a couple years ago, but that couldn't quite calm his mind. The only thing that could achieve that was mechanic work. It was his form of active meditation. They placed the hubcaps on top of flat cardboard boxes in Gordo's trunk and zipped them up in an oversized duffel bag. Ready to call it a day, Gordo asked. Growing sick and tired of this heat, it was September and 88 degrees. His fat ass couldn't handle it anymore. Yeah, let's get some food. Gordo cruised down the street, eyeing the restaurants, trying to figure out which one would satisfy his hunger. Should we get shrimp broccoli or... Marcus interrupted, pointing to a Honda Civic. Stop. The car, nigga. Stain alert. What the fuck are you talking about? Gordo saw the Civic as they slowed down and noticed the driver's door wasn't quite shut properly. This happened once in a blue moon, but whenever it happened, Gordo thanked whoever was running things in the sky. Get out, and I'll cruise around the block. Grab whatever you can, but be slick about it. I know you got hands. I'll be back in 2 minutes flat. Bet. Gordo watched Marcus get out and thought about handing him his piece, but decided to chill. Chinatown seemed deserted, and no one would say shit to Marcus. Driving down the block, Gordo wondered how much money they would be bringing in with their latest stain. The parts had to be worth a pretty penny and might bring his savings to the next level. Gordo dreamt of moving somewhere warm like Cali, Hawaii, or maybe even Panama. Maybe he'd be able to reconnect to his roots and really figure out what happened to his father once and for all. He pulled up alongside the busted Civic, and Marcus had a new duffel bag ready. Marcus opened the passenger door and hopped inside with a huge grin on his face. "Pull off, nigga. We hit the mother load." "What are you talking about?" Gordo said, growing annoyed. Marcus unzipped the bag and opened it up, and Gordo saw stacks of $100 bills with thick rubber bands choking the money. "Bands, nigga, bands," Marcus said, gripping a sack in his hand. "Put that shit away. I'm getting stressed the fuck out just looking at it." "All right, all right." "You don't think it was anyone important we just jacked, do you?" "Whoever has that whip ain't important. Just saying." "Maybe you're right. I just got this funny feeling in my stomach." Gordo turned up the volume in his car, listening to the local radio station play some Future. "God blessing all the trap niggas," spilled out the speakers. Listening to Future's drugged out raps filled the interior of his ride. He wondered if Future was right. Maybe this was good karma paying off, finally. A cool breeze drifted inside the car, and Gordo shivered. He turned a corner and a siren went off. Blue and red lights reflected off Gordo's rearview mirror. "Fuck, it's the cops," Gordo said. "Ain't that a bitch?" Marcus shot Gordo a stressed out look, gesturing towards the bag of money in his lap. "Throw it in the back seat. We're about to take a huge gamble." Marcus put the bag in the back and wiped his sweaty hands on his jeans. Gordo turned down the music, hoping his hunch would pay off. This was one of those times he had to put his faith into his gut and ride with it. Most of the time, it worked in his favor. Waiting for the cop to approach the car, Gordo reached into his pocket, rubbing the Panamanian Balboa coin for good luck. He needed every bit of it right now. Gordo watched the cop saunter over to his window, stand with his hands on his hips. The cop was about 5'5", with shades and a military haircut. He chewed on a mint obnoxiously. The smell made Gordo sick to his stomach. "Good evening. Could I see your license and registration?" "Yeah. Marcus, hand me the stuff out the glove box." "Do it slowly." Gordo nearly balled up the registration in his hand before passing it to the cop. The cop took it and started looking through the documents, fingers running across each line, and then stared at the license. He compared the face on the car to Gordo's. "You've gained a bit of weight, haven't you?" Gordo gripped the steering wheel tightly, wishing he could rip it off and beat the cop to death with it. Instead, he took a deep breath and rubbed the coin in his pocket furiously, hoping it would absorb the anger swelling inside his chest. "Looks like you're good to go. Either way, you should put that duffel bag to use and hit the gym more often." Marcus leaned over, getting the cop's attention. "Thanks, sir. Have a good day." "You too." The cop walked away, keys jingling by his side. The cop got in his car, put the car into drive, and slowly drove off. "Fuck that nigga," Gordo said. "We still got the money," Marcus said. Gordo had almost completely forgotten. He looked in the back seat, almost amazed that the bag was still there. "Oh shit, it worked." "Hell yeah, it worked. Looks like we'll be getting out of the city sooner than later." That's it. Thank you.
Give it up for Grant one more time. Yeah, I interviewed Grant for Lit Reactor. It's going to drop, I think, on Wednesday, if you want to check it out. Last but not least, we've got James Nulick. He's the author of Haunted Girlfriend, Valencia, Moon Down to Earth, and his new book, Lazy Eyes, a short story collection, is out now on Expat, finally displayed right there. Without further ado, reason why we're all here, James Nulick. His first public reading in 15 years or something like that. So, yeah, you're lucky.
Thank you.
Them, not you.
Thank you. You reversed the appearance of us, right? On the, I was supposed to go first, and you were going to go last.
No. This is you. This is all you.
Okay, because I've been waiting so long that now I have to like go to the bathroom. Anyway, and not number one either. But anyway, so with that out of the way, this is from Lazy Eyes. It's called Doe, as in Baby Boy Doe or John Doe. And it's based on a true story in Seattle about, I won't go into it too much, but basically it was about a mother who murdered her child. And I was so upset by the story that I did what comes naturally to me. I wrote about it. So without any further explanation, this is Doe. It's julienned quite a bit for time. But dangling by a thick rope from the mouth of her vagina, the cold kiss of wet porcelain, and into the waters again, though this time the water is heart-shockingly cold, not warm, nor life-giving. It is the cold of an anodized casket buried in the deepest part of the ocean, the cold of fluorescent tubes in a bus station at 1 a.m. The clerk waiting for nothing to happen, scrolling pornography on his phone. The dead child in an incubator lights up the nitrile caress before the inevitable cataloging and wastebasket toss. Time of death, 11:33 p.m. Remember this, the water in my newly blind eyes. Unseeing for the first time. The cold water of the restroom mixing with the remnants of my amniotic fluid. So much expenditure of energy to come into this world. I just want to breathe. Please give me this. Allow me this. I have been enrolled in your welcome darkness for so long. The water, and then dark, stilled. And in that one instant, you have stolen my first kiss, my first driving test, the first girl I took to the prom, my first day at university, all this gone in an instant, and my cries, heard by an attendant and a paying customer, ignored, forgotten. I live in the shadow realm with tissues and sanitary napkins, used lipstick, unwanted numbers scrawled on tumbler-ringed napkins. When the moment seemed right, the rings aging the night. One drink, two drinks, three drinks, four. When the bottom shelf whiskey colored the dollhouse of your skull, candy pink. A halo caressing the top of your head as he whispered yes in your ear. And now under the harsh surgical light of a gas station convenience store, shelves ebullient with condoms and motor oil, signifiers of future movement. The napkin balled in anger and tossed into the metal cabinet of the women's restroom, not without regret. Perhaps he was the one. Perhaps the ink of his number is etched in the valley of my palm by the flesh sweat of my own nervousness. The confluence of yes and no recorded in blue uniball. The napkin grazing the discarded compact with a smudge mirror, the mirror having fallen downward throughout the night and into the day. What kind of sociopath throws away a mirror? And I can see, I guess God likes what I'm saying. And I can see my reflection in it, a child without a name, without a past, without a mother, without a future, a country, 7 pounds and 7 ounces of flesh, smothered in clear film, the humming of drill bit lights blinding, gasping for air, a water birth, and despite my attempts in a tiny chest filled with new lungs, I can't breathe. There are laws that govern the nature of the universe, the physicality of the flesh, the hologram of text over flesh, how the word creates the world. And when a word exits the eternal heat of the mouth, when that word is no, An entire world is destroyed. The universe. To keep warm during the day, I hide in electrical outlets. The toaster, an old convection oven, given to her by her mother, my grandmother. Anything that houses the form of my body. I snuggle 24-gauge copper telephone lines stapled under the eaves of the apartment house to sunbathe on the gray surface of a demarcation point. The humming of a wasp's nest bustling with fierce energy keeps me entertained for hours. Can they see me? Am I real? A real boy? Or only a wraith in their multifaceted eyes? Their heart-shaped heads, dangerous jewelry, with topaz eyes and yellow jaws. My heart masticated by those jaws, wondering before the great becoming. Is it safer to remain an idea? Or should the push of the spirit fulfill the promise of the form? To fulfill the promise, to become a wakeful, crawling into walking being, with lips that utter needs when age has acquired a certain weight. What rational being would want this? Her phone is a polished block from outer space, finely engineered, no sharp edges, perfect and black. It sits on the nightstand next to her, a cord connected to it disappearing into the darkness under the bed. A long white tail. I look at my reflection in the gorilla glass. My reflection is constantly moving, like bees over a comb. I'm kind of here, but mostly not. Is color a superficial phenomenon? Or does it come from within? Does it emanate from a primordial source, deep within the structure, thoroughly saturated, part of its noumenal self? Or is it merely a surfactant, easily parceled with knives or lasers? I dreamed I asked this question once before in another iteration, and here I am, asking it again, the question still resolved in my most personal mind, unresolved, sir. I am lonely, and I cannot touch her. I have so many questions. Will this go on forever? Is there any way to turn my mind off? Stop wandering over incessant thoughts that go nowhere. I've only arrived and already I want to leave. How do I just stop being? Mothers who put themselves first always have damaged sons. 1 + 8 + 0 = 9. Concentrating on my feet, moving all my life force from my head to my feet, I willed myself into 108 months. Which is how old I am today. It's 9, if you're not good with math. I like being this age, this height. People trust you at this age. Plus, I can take things from the countertop without struggling. My body is neither boy nor girl. I am an in-betweener. It's like I'm this shiny wallpaper people are trying to figure out but can't. Do I shine from the inside? Or does the shine come from the light reflected off the surface of my body? The only way to know for sure is by touch. If you pull me close, I glisten. If you pull me even closer, as close as you can, things start to make less sense. A nipple becomes alba mons, my sun-peached flesh, valleys you love to get lost in. You hide in my body and become who you really are. I patiently wait in the microwave oven. I am slowly deleting everything I am, everything I ever was, and everything I ever will be, becoming one with the smallest particle of light. Disappearing, breathless and voiceless, I do not have a name. I ask the flesh to release its hold over me. I do not want this. I am now and forever emptying into nothingness, my bones breaking over rocks in the river, my back broken. I flow into the estuary of my mother's body, and everything begins again. Though this time, I have the power to harness her anger, her hatred, her denial of me, and I turn it back within herself. We are two beings connected to each other by a silver cord. I unfold in the darkness, a purple-black flower on the Berber, my legs growing stronger with each step. I am naked and unashamed, as I was my first day on Earth, born without the knowledge of shame, filth, hatred, hopelessness. God is, if anything, symmetrical. I have two feet that work perfectly, feet that can be perfectly bound. Today I am 9, 108 months, and I find this body much more enjoyable than the body my mother's body created for me, though I am not sure how I willed this exact body into being. The ethereal history of human memory did not do this for me. I created this body, willing it into itself. An external self I think about as an object in the world I call me. Being in itself, for me, for my own experiences. To walk, to speak, to pick a ring of keys from a bowl near the front door and hide them, move them elsewhere, play tricks on her. With this specific spirit housed in this specific body, I could not do this, move physical objects that exist in the world, without this body I had created. A very specific projection of a self I must have wanted at this very moment. Think about it as you sit there and wonder about the body that you're housed in. How this body, a body I have neither inhabited nor have ever seen before, is it really that incredible when you think about it? Willing a physical body from an etheric body, an object drawn from the ether into the here and now. Is this not how the universe was formed? Thank you.
Give it up one more time for James Newick. That's going to do it, folks. We all got books for sale. If you want to check them out right there and then buy them at the counter, would be much appreciated. And talk amongst yourselves, do what you do. Thank you for being here.